From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maybe what gave T.S. Eliot such a fresh voice was that he straddled worlds, America and Britain, the 19th century and the 20th, great poets and writers past, and the modern world humming around him like the biggest machine of the machine age. Some of what he wrote about women, about Jewishness, makes you cringe today. But who can take away from him, I grow old, I shall wear the bottom of my trousers rolled, or April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of dead land. This hour On Point, the poetry of T.S. Eliot and the life and mind and times behind it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are there lines of T.S. Eliot that have anchored themselves in your memory? Are you ready to read him, hear him again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And listeners, some fine news. iTunes has named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. If you miss a broadcast, our podcast is always there. Subscribe at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. You can link to all that at our website, onpointradio.org. In the studio with me now today is Christopher Ricks, a titan of the world of literary criticism and poetry. He's published many books on Eliot, not to mention Tennyson, Milton, Keats, Ezra Pound, Bob Dylan. John Sutherland, writing in the Financial Times last month, calls him our greatest living commentator on literature. He's just published, along with co-editor Jim McHugh, two new volumes, The Poems of T.S. Eliot, Collected and Uncollected Poems, and The Poems of T.S. Eliot, Practical Cats and Further Verses, full of amazing explanation and history and more. They are getting raves. Christopher Ricks, welcome back to On Point.
Many thanks.
How lovely to have you here. I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about Bob Dylan.
We were. Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the Captain's Tower while Calypso singers laugh at them.
And there we're in Bob Dylan land right away. Is it a long stretch for you from Dylan to T.S. Eliot? Do you have to shift gears in some fundamental way?
It's less of a stretch from one genius to another than from a genius to somebody who isn't.
All up in that same terrain. T.S. Eliot will be very, very well known to many. To all, there are lines that have become part of our regular speech. To others, kind of distant. I want to just listen to him for a moment, reciting his own. This is from 1951. T.S. Eliot reading the unforgettable opening lines of maybe his most famous poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. He wrote it between 1910 and 1911. It was first published 100 years ago. It's a different sound reading then, but let's listen.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit.
T.S. Eliot, reading his work from 1910-11 there in 1951, half-deserted streets and muttering retreats. I think Dylan could work with that. He was so young when he wrote this, and he was helping crack open the modernist. What is it about the reading we just heard that might suggest that to you?
Well, it's the most extraordinary inauguration ever. This is his first published poem. Ezra Pound, who very promptly recognized Eliot's genius. Pound was very, very generous towards other writers, recognized his genius, and talked about the way in which Eliot had modernized himself on his own. On the other hand, of course, it's full of very beautiful reminiscences of Victorian poetry. Eliot always works by retuning, fine-tuning, sometimes in a very good way, coarse-tuning, turning something which was delicate in the original into something valuably sordid. But behind this, there's Robert Browning, there's Alfred Tennyson. There are all those dramatic monologues in which somebody is in silent conversation with somebody else.
Your new works with Jim McHugh are full of the elaboration of what lies behind all of these lines. But some of what makes it modernist is, I guess, right there, like a patient etherized upon a table. When that line came out to describe the evening spread out against the sky, it caused, in literary circles anyway, kind of an uproar. What was that about?
Well, it's the sudden, mysterious, jarring change of register, as linguistics people say, and so on. Etherized is, of course, a pun on the ether. That is, the evening and the sky are the ether. It's ethereal. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a line of a French poem behind it which describes the goddess of love ethereal, but Eliot turns it turns it from ethereal into etherized, and that's part of the Boston story because of the Ether Museum here in Boston, which Eliot knew about, the ether room.
His was an old Boston family before they, by route of St. Louis, went west.
Yes, just so.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't help as I was reading through your book. I mean, it's a tremendous piece of scholarship. Its ambition struck me as almost, forgive me, but almost monstrous. I mean, you are trying to almost live inside the mind and relationships of a man over decades and tease out almost line by line. I mean, there are many more pages of what can read like super footnotes here than there are of poetry. Now, Eliot himself said, genuine, as you well know, genuine poetry can communicate before it is understood, which sounds like a kind of rejection of the very project that you've completed so magnificently here. So do we need to know?
The answer is we don't need. That is, I very much want to resist the word need. It's a little bit like, do we need on point? Well, we profit from
please.
It.
It's a
terrifically good thing.
Boy, you cut right to the heart.
No, but it's a terrifically good thing mm-hmm. where it doesn't make sense, I think, in terms of needing. Mm-hmm. We're talking about all the things that make life worth living but are not food.
A good night's sleep is much more important, I'll grant you that.
Okay. I'm not
okay. No, but, no,
but and, of course, Eliot says before it is understood. He doesn't say genuine poetry can communicate without being understood, or mm-hmm. there's no need to understand it. Mm-hmm. The first stage is that it thrills you through its sound, through its auditory imagination. Mm-hmm. It possesses you because that's an extraordinary sound, and it's very close relation to music. He loved music. He knew a lot about music. It was wonderful that Stravinsky, that he gave permission to Stravinsky, gave permission to Stravinsky to set something. Mm-hmm. Do you need these notes? No. It's important that the publisher keep in print a simple, plain text of Eliot's poems. It would be monstrous to pick up your happy accusation. It would be monstrous if this were the only edition which people could read Eliot. This is for
those... Because it weighs 10 pounds, you have to hold it in your lap to read it and so on. And yet, there's so much richness in what you bring.
Do go on.
Well, I mean, it's there. You can trace all these lines back into his personal relationship with his wives, with Ezra Pound, as you say, and then back to the poets who inspired him. I want to hear more on that, but I wish you'd go to this turn to the modern. I mean, he's associated with this, and I wish you'd explain what makes his poetry represent that. Why was he seen as the kind of harbinger or cutting edge or of that?
Well, you bring a lot of things into poetry which had been excluded from it. That is, every great writer needs to find ways to defend his or her kind of writing against the absolutely conventional form of it. Poetry always needs to be defended against the poetical, the idea that poetry is about daffodils or about feeling sorry for yourself mm-hmm. or about not liking getting old. These are great poeticalities, as films need to protect themselves against the rather easy effects that films can do. Mm-hmm. Dreams. Mm-hmm. Dreams are too easy in films. Mm-hmm. So the move is, the revolutionary aspect is, let's find ways of breaking out of the poetical. That means for Eliot at first, bring over from the novel. He's the author in that first volume, of course, of Portrait of a Lady. Mm-hmm. He knows perfectly well that Henry James has written a novel of that name, and it's as if the whole novel is compacted into five pages which don't fill in all the gaps, fill in the stories. Mm-hmm. So part of the modern thing is a delight in riddles. You can think all mm-hmm. poetry has something riddling about it. I love riddles, mm-hmm. and I love the Oxford Book of Nursery Rhymes because it's got riddles in it. And when I did the Oxford book of English verse. I put riddles in.
Why would riddles and the modern go together? Because the old verities were forgotten, lost, distrusted?
That's very good. Your point. I hadn't thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense. The old verities are always being tested. That is, it's not that only the new is to be trusted and only the new to be valued. I think it's a great pity these days innovation is mentioned 100 times for any mention of tradition. Mm-hmm. Tradition is immensely valuable. Everywhere we're being asked, is this new? Is this a brand new course you're teaching? Mm-hmm. Because if it's the old one, what happened to the idea that it's the idea in the Book of Revelation, it's in T.S. Eliot, and it's in Bob Dylan, strengthen the things that remain. Now, that doesn't say innovate. It's not against mm-hmm. innovation, but strengthen the things that remain. To be able to combine a revolutionary energy and fervor with strengthening the things that remain, with tradition, that's genius.
Of course, T.S. Eliot was seen as towering, but he also took heat. Somewhere along these same lines, part of the tradition that he valued seemed to emerge from him as straight-up anti-Semitism sometimes.
Yeah. There are ugly traditions. I'm not suggesting that all the traditions are good. A language has a problem. The verb to Jew is a very shocking verb. On the other hand, the Oxford English Dictionary was right to fight complaints that it had included the word. We really do need to confront the history and the terrible prejudices which are built into the language.
Was he confronting or perpetuating T.S. Eliot?
Well, it
reads
depends.
Like perpetuation to my ear.
Well, there are different cases. My book on Eliot and Prejudice tries to distinguish the cases where Eliot speaks in his own person, for instance, lectures in Virginia, mm-hmm. And a poem like Gerontion, which is about a diseased, embittered, and done-for consciousness and soul. Now, that voice speaks of the Jew squats on the windowsill, mm-hmm. but I've never met anybody who said, I'd really like to be like the speaker of that poem. The speaker of that poem is not endorsed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are exploring the mind and work of the great poet and more, T.S. Eliot, in this hour with the great scholar of T.S. Eliot, Christopher Ricks. He and Jim McHugh are out with two big volumes of poems, some, not much or any published at all, lots and lots and lots of background and commentary, mainly background on these poems, what the allusions allude to in T.S. Eliot, the poems of T.S. Eliot collected and uncollected, the poems of T.S. Eliot, Practical Cats, and further verses. Yes, Practical Cats, as in what ended up with through Andrew Lloyd Webber's hands as Cats on Broadway. Christopher Ricks is with me in the studio. You can join us as well. Are you ready to read T.S. Eliot again, T.S. Eliot always? Are you prepared to put up with T.S. Eliot, the far-from-PC poet, T.S. Eliot's alleged anti-Semitism and more? And where do you hear the modernist emerging in T.S. Eliot? A little more of the man in his own voice here, reading the opening lines of The Burial of the Dead. This is part one of The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers.
T.S. Eliot from The Wasteland. Christopher Ricks, eminent scholar of all things T.S. Eliot, with me in the studio. Remind us just briefly of his biography, how it was that he spanned the United States and England, became eventually what renounced his U.S. citizenship ultimately. His old Boston family, he grew up in St. Louis, but then what was it that took him across the pond and kept him there?
Dissatisfaction with your great country in some ways. He thought that he was more of a European than an American, mm-hmm. which is something that Henry James and a lot of other people have thought. Mm-hmm. He went to Oxford. That attracted him very much. He studied under the great philosopher F.H. Bradley. Then he fell in love with the first Mrs. Eliot, as she proved to be, mm-hmm. Vivian Haig Wood. And he had a very successful career as a journalist and then publisher.
Throughout his production at least what was published, was not enormous. He wanted everyone to count, everyone to make a statement, but there weren't that many poems compared to many others.
Well, he wrote a lot, but he was very severe about what he released. That is, he said that you shouldn't ever write, and you certainly shouldn't ever publish a poem unless it was necessary. And necessary meant that you hadn't done that sort of thing before. He has very, very, or that nobody had done it. You needed to know what had been done. You needed the kind of knowledge of your art that you'd expect from a scientist. You needed the kind of knowledge of your abilities that you needed as an athlete. If you're an athlete, you better know you're good at this and not that. So there's a strict discipline in him. He loved discipline.
What was most arresting to people in his voice, in his message, that made him such a towering figure for so much of the 20th century?
Well, I think a huge thing was his telling people that they didn't necessarily know their own feelings. We tend to think we know our feelings. We don't know where we stand philosophically, perhaps religiously, but we know our feelings. He said about intelligence that its important function was the discernment of exactly what and how much you feel in any given situation. And he thinks, as a lot of people do, that art is not more about feeling than it is about thinking, but it is about discerning exactly what and how much you feel. He hated newspapers because he thought they were designed to kid you that you had feelings that you didn't have. And he praised the great French novelist Stendhal for his understanding of human feeling and human illusions of feeling. Now, that hasn't got better. We're in a world in which people kid themselves that they care about things that actually they don't give a rap about.
That is so much truth in so few sentences.
His truth, not mine.
Yes, his truth. I'll take it. And yet he spoke against the use of emotion in his poetry itself. Did he not?
Well, I don't
Leaning on emotion?
Well, he, like a lot of philosophers, he thought that emotion was a complicated matter. He begins as a professional philosopher. He could have had a job in the philosophy department at Harvard, but he decided not to return to complete the defense for the... he's not simply against emotion, I think. But in the lamplight, well, how about this? Arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? That's full of emotion. It's wonderfully erotic. He is a great erotic poet, partly because he's very afraid of erotic feelings, as is wise of him.
Christopher Ricks is writing up and down about T.S. Eliot. He's with us today. Lots of callers for you. Paula in Atlanta, Georgia. Paula, thank you for calling. You're on the table. On the table, excuse me, on the air.
Etherized.
Sorry, Paula. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to raise for us the question of why, for me, 40 years out of college, having read T.S. Eliot, his imagery from visceral to mystical just stays with us. And I know a number of people who reread the Four Quartets around this time of year, every year. Why does he have this staying power beyond understanding the imagery and the significance behind the illusions? There's something just on the page that speaks to us and continues to speak to us for decades after we first encounter it.
I so agree. We'll put it to the master, Paula.
I think he means me. The master we'd have to reach on the Ouija board, get Mr. Eliot in the afterlife.
Well.
It is what he himself called the auditory imagination. It's a feeling for every syllable and every cadence. To put it in that way is immediately to enter into a whole world in which your thinkings and feelings are intimate with one another. It's very, very hard to catch how that works, to say that the giving famishes the craving. Now, it just sounds insinuatingly wonderful. He knows perfectly well that if verse doesn't have its own music, many, many kinds of music, it can never come home to us. Art realizes things for us. And I think it's very, very fine that you have found in your life that the art realizes again and again. This time of year is a beautiful thought, too.
Why so? Why this time of year? It's dark. We're more introspective.
Well, because even for those of us who are not Christians, I'm not a Christian because I ceased to believe that the religion was true. Mm-hmm. I also have doubts about whether the religion would be a good religion if it were true. These are complicated questions. Mm-hmm. But at this time of year, everybody has to take religion in general and probably Christianity in particular, despite all the proper recognitions of other religions, has to take it very seriously. And Eliot's genius is in understanding the way in which art helps you to entertain beliefs that you don't hold. We are very, very bad at respecting beliefs that we don't hold. There are only two ways in which we ever come to do it. One is by loving people who hold those beliefs. My oldest child is a Christian. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think, of course, again about what Christianity is. Or by works of art. Works of art put us in sympathetic company with beliefs, whether we hold them or not. And it's a very, very important addition to our lives.
We think of modernism, and Paula, thank you for your call from Atlanta. We think of somehow of modernism and religion or the sacred in opposition, in tension, and yet he is well known for both.
Yes, well, the great discovery for him was Dante, and he is, of course, somebody who learnt Italian to read Dante, as he says, not was able to read Dante because he knew Italian. Mm. And he writes simply wonderfully about Dante, and his last great poem, really his last poem, Little Gidding, has these wonderful 50 or 60 lines that are a close imitation of great moments in Dante.
Let's go to another listener here, Carl, in Kingston, Rhode Island. Carl, thank you for calling. You are on the air with Christopher Ricks.
Hi, Tom. Hello, Christopher. Thank you very much. Yes, speaking of Little Gidding, I've found some use for it in my research, which is into space travel and how we'll adapt to that.
No less. Little Gidding from Four Quartets, and how does it take you to space travel, Carl?
Indeed, and I'm certainly not taking it in a religious context, but the idea that when we actually, as humans, start to live in space, we will have to abandon a lot of what we know and have to reinvent ourselves a lot. And then there's that wonderful, there's those wonderful lines in the second to last stanza, "We shall not cease from exploring, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Where in the end, what all this means is we'll discover what we are on Earth.
And there's something so intoxicating about that, it never fails to make one stop and think. And so you're going to pack that along to Mars, Carl.
I'm sorry?
You're going to pack that one along to Mars when you go?
I think Little Gidding should be in the bags on the way to Mars and beyond, yes. Inspire everyone.
I love your call. Christopher Ricks, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time.
Well, I was very struck by your saying intoxicating, because intoxicating is right, but the lines are very sober. What's beautiful is the combination of a great sobriety of tone, not ecstasy, not on drugs, not overexcited, and so on. Now, the space travel thing is fascinating to me. The greatest beneficiary of Eliot as poet and critic was William Empson, who loved the poems of John Donne and wrote a famous article called Donne, the Spaceman. And it's about the relations of Christianity, of course, to space travel and the huge problems which C.S. Lewis wrote a series of novels about. Does there have to be a Christ on every planet?
That's a metaphysical challenge. I love the range you talk about, his seriousness, and yet at the same time he can be intoxicating.
Look that at the way your word.
Yes, all right.
Your good word.
We'll let it stand, I guess. But here, the guy who wrote The Wasteland, who was also inspiring Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats. I mean, that's incredible. And you look at Alfred J. Prufrock. I mean, I grow old, I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair beyond? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. All kind of fun, but then also it goes right on. I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. And you're from something wonderfully visceral and fey almost to something profoundly serious there.
I agree. These extraordinary changes, shifts, modulations. He's a great modulator.
We've got callers coming and going here, but continuing to ask about his anti-Semitism. And you've been speaking of his Christianity. Put it in context again. Did he deny anti-Semitism? Did he say, well, I don't know, maybe?
Well, he did deny it. He thought it was an unjust accusation. I think there are certain things in him where it is undeniable. Reasons of race and religion combined to make any large number of free-thinking Jews undesirable. He should never have written
that. What did he mean by that? What would be undesirable to T.S. Eliot about a free-thinking person?
No, to a culture, to a society. He did think that free...
Because he wanted tradition to bind and hold.
He wanted tradition to bind. He thought, as a lot of people do, that a certain cohesion in society is essential.
And he meant religious cohesion or cultural via religion in that case.
Well, you say all this in Virginia.
Yes, it's not.
But it's your country.
It's this planet.
No, I agree. You're putting it as if I would remonstrate with you. No, he should never have written that. On the other hand, as I say, Gerontion is different. And The Wasteland, of course, has very, very beautifully Gentile or Jew. And it thinks of the pity that we should have for anybody drowned at sea, Gentile or Jew.
Carol in Lake Placid, New York. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would also like to give credit to Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales, Fragment 1, Group A, the general prologue. And that begins, "When that April with his surest suit, the drought of March hath perished to the root, and bathed every vein in such liquor, of which virtue engendered is the fleur. When the fire athique with his sweet breath inspired hath in every holt and heath the tender crops, and the young sun hath in the ram his halves cord Ivana, and make small fowls make in melody."
Oh, Carol, you're right in Christopher Rick's territory there.
Pardon?
You're right in Christopher Rick's territory, taking us back to origins in Chaucer.
I was at Cornell in the 50s. And so I did study Dante, both in the Italian and the English. But, of course, if we want a precedent before him, we have the Canterbury Tales.
Carol, thank you so much for that lovely reading. And there you get April, something like the cruelest month, or intimations back in Chaucer.
Yes, it's very, very beautiful. If I say it's well known, I mean that makes it even better rather than the opposite. Mm-hmm. Eliot's first wife, Vivian, actually quotes those lines and so on. And they are part, of course, of this greatest of our marital misery poems, which is what The Wasteland is. But thank you, yes, for that.
And yet, there's Eliot again saying, this is 1962, if I've got this right, "I will not allow any academic critic to provide notes of explanation to be published with any of my poems." Well, you've got pounds and pounds of such notes right here. Are you offending the man?
No, we're not. I have it from I'm not a spiritualist, so I don't know whether we're offending the man. We certainly didn't offend the widow, Mrs. Eliot, at whose invitation this whole thing has happened. Mrs. Eliot, I think, can be held to know Eliot better than anybody else. Her marriage with him late was a very, very happy one.
And she lived until just a couple of years ago, his second
wife. Yes, she died in her early 80s, not very long ago. Notes of explanation. You see, most of our notes are quotations from Eliot himself. That is, it is Eliot who says to the actor Michael Redgrave that this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Eliot said to Michael Redgrave for a BBC broadcast, "It should be like a child's counting out rhyme." Now, that's a wonderful, wonderful thought about it. I wish I had had that thought myself. I love it that the poet knew that about it, because nursery rhymes are everywhere in that poem, The Hollow Men, and everywhere in Eliot. He loved nursery rhymes. So what our note there is not a bright idea that we've had. It's telling you Mr. Eliot's own idea for a great actor in utterance.
And lighting up all the poetry and our minds as we take it in. Christopher Ricks is with us. The poems of T.S. Eliot, Volume 1 and 2. What a range, from The Wasteland to Cats behind us. Jellicle Songs for Jellicle Cats from the Broadway production. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are exploring the mind and work of the great poet and more, T.S. Eliot, in this hour. Poet, playwright, himself quite the critic. With the great scholar of T.S. Eliot, Christopher Ricks, he's out with two big volumes of the poems of T.S. Eliot and lots and lots and lots of background to understanding origins and thoughts on those poems, co-edited with Jim McHugh. Christopher Ricks is in the studio, and you can join us. What's your question for Christopher Ricks about where all this came from? What's the T.S. Eliot line, the stanza that always plays in your head? And are you with the playful T.S. Eliot of the old possum and cats, the somber T.S. Eliot of the wasteland? I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. We know these lines. You are the music while the music lasts. If you aren't in over your head, how do you know how tall you are? I will show you fear in a handful of dust. And this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. John in Worcester, Massachusetts, you are on with Christopher Ricks. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for this great conversation today. And thanks to your esteemed guest for all the great work that he has done. I find T.S. Eliot to be more meaningful and relevant than ever, and that's why I think it's so important. I think the two things that stand out to me the most that really kind of hooked me is his sort of cinematic quality to his writing, especially considering The Wasteland in particular. It was written in the early 20s, and I think the stuff that he was doing with words was things that great film directors weren't even able to do until 30, 40 years later. I'm thinking particularly in the fire sermon section where we sort of zoom in on this record playing and then it sort of follows the music out the window and down the street and over the river. And you just, it's probably my favorite movie scene and it's not even in a movie.
I love it. I love it.
You know, it's just brilliant. And I guess the second part would be its relevance. I think of nowadays we have apps and these news sort of gathering things like Flipboard on our iPads, and they really are, and just everything is just sort of this heap of broken images, and it's this verse that sticks with me the most, the heap of broken images, and here we are still trying to figure it out, still sitting on our shore trying to make sense of these ruins that are sort of washing up to us every day. So I thank you so much, and any comments you would have on that would be great. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, John. I mean, cinematic indeed, and to take us to these heaps of ruins, that can sound perfectly relevant today. Do you see T.S. Eliot as cinematic, particularly Christopher Ricks? You certainly could write lyrics for any great singer, but what about the cinema?
Well, he hated the cinema. I mean, the caller in is absolutely right that there is something hugely cinematic, and maybe Eliot's dislike of the cinema, he thought that it was a sort of mob art. He thought he was quite unjust to it. He was snobbish, basically, about it. The cinema gets into the Wasteland manuscript, and it's really about the crowds who lose their minds in a sort of mass, which is not the holy mass. I mean, that's the thing. But the point is absolutely right. And one might add that Eisenstein learnt about cinema from John Milton, from Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. If we moved back to space travel, mm-hmm. it was these great visions of Milton that inspired Eisenstein.
And the broken world of our time, he had the broken world of the disillusioned World War I generation. We have both the thrilling and the despair-making internet breaking and delivering all the time.
Yes. And that was the sense that Tennyson already had. And Tennyson thought that an awful lot of the things that entertain us break us apart. He said that newspapers break your mind in pieces. Now, I don't think it's true, but I think it's a wise thing to think about. What truth is there in the idea that everything gets fragmented? The global village, you can call it, but it really means you don't have a sense of your locality anymore. Boston.
We'll go to that. I jokingly called your ambition here monstrous because so many micro angles of these poems are illuminated. I mean, here we're talking about the broken detritus, and then you take us to Vivian Elliott along the Thames, talking about the water was dirty, in it lay many cigarette ends and cards and matches and old rags and bits of refuse flung or dropped from windows above. I mean, it's so practical. It's so just so real. And there it is in T.S. Eliot. There's much in these books that we may not have read because it didn't end up in the final form of these poems. From The Wasteland, for example. Let me just play a bit of this. This is Michael Hammond reading the original opening lines from The Wasteland, Part 1, The Burial of the Dead. Instead of the quiet description of April's cruelty, the cruelest month, here we are in Boston on a drunken night out. Michael Hammond reading.
First, we had a couple of feelers down at Tom's place. There was old Tom, boiled to the eyes, blind. Don't you remember that time after a dance, top hats and all, we and Silk Hat Harry and old Tom took us behind, brought out a bottle of fizz.
Fizz, and we end up with April as the cruelest month. How did he get from that, to the original we just heard, to this much more reduced and grand in its own simple way, beginning?
When he started here at home, I liked the idea, incidentally, that this program should be called Tom's Place. I mean, that was the first line of the Wasteland as originally written. It was going to begin in the New World. It was going to begin in the bars and brothels, because it's a brothel scene, this, with the corrupt police and so on. It's a brothel scene.
Hello, Boston.
It was going to begin here and then go to Europe. But in fact, like the poet, it just went to Europe. Ezra Pound is not the person who cut this first page out. T.S. Eliot cut out this first page, and he came back later to brothels and that savage world in the poems of 1920, in the poem called Sweetie Erect, which is entirely set in the brothel, and which he didn't want his mother to read. Mm-hmm. He didn't know what to do about the shock that some of his poems would cause in the family. But I think it's a very, very beautiful thought that at first it was going to be a New World poem. And, of course, at the time of Prohibition, that is drunkenness in 1922 and drink in 1922.
An issue in and of itself.
And his family was terrifically against any regulation of brothels. That is, the family had a crusade against any attempt. And indeed, his father said that he hoped that a cure for venereal disease would never be found, because if it were found, it would encourage this terrible licentiousness by which people fornicated. So it was a very puritanical family. And these opening scenes were local. They're Boston.
You said Ezra Pound did not have a hand in that particular editing, but he did sometimes have quite a hand in the editing of T.S. Eliot. We gave him the nickname Old Possum, which then takes us right back to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Cats and all that. What was Pound's role in what we've come to understand and read as T.S. Eliot's poetry?
Well, it wasn't limited to The Wasteland, but it was huge in The Wasteland. The major cut of the section about death by water, from a long narrative about a great sea journey down to the few lines about Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead. So those few lines are all that Pound left from that huge narrative, which is in the manner of Tennyson. It's like Tennyson's Ulysses. So those were very big changes. Influence in 1920 on those poems. But when the poems became, as they promptly did, Christian, mystical, devout, Pound loses them and they lose Pound.
And so the editor's pencil comes out, the cuts begin?
No, he doesn't attend them. I think he ceased to be,
Pound disengaged.
Really ceased to be interested in what was now at the center of Eliot's genius. He wrote very, very beautifully after Eliot died, and he ended with these great words, read him. This was the admonition of read him.
And yet through Pound, I have to come back again. I mean, Pound, famously sympathetic to fascist Europe. You know, and of course, as you well know, I mean, you've written on this, but Anthony Julius has written as well, talking about Eliot. He says, we ought not to seek to outlaw Eliot's poems, again, on this anti-Semitism front, but neither can we submit to them. We should not ban them, but we must not abandon ourselves to them Instead, we must contest that poetry with strategies that acknowledge both its value and its menace.
That's very good. Except the word strategies. People who live all the time, nowhere near an army, they're always talking about strategies and tactics. These are cowards who sit around on chairs and they write strategies.
Well, but calling out value and menace is not a cowardly undertaking.
Yeah, okay.
I would say. Joan in West Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm really excited about this program because I discovered Eliot when I was in high school quite a while ago, and it's just his words have just resonated with me for a very long time. And I just wanted to touch on a specific poem, Burnt Norton, which
from the Four Quartets.
Yes, yes.
What's your question there, Joan?
Well, it's really not a question. It's a comment about a very beautiful part here that I really love that I wanted to just comment on. It's at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards. At the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point. There would be no dance, and there is only the dance. I can only say, there we have been, but I cannot say where, and I cannot say how long, for that is no place to place it in time.
Joan, thank you so much for that. We're looking at T.S. Eliot and there from the Burnt Norton portion of Four Quartets. Christopher Ricks, that still point of the turning world, there is the dance. What is that still point?
Well, the still point has to be caught in the very words, and I'm glad we heard the very words, and it's the difference between there is the dance and there the dance is. Now, there the dance is perfectly poised in that moment. Yes. It's as if it is itself like a ballet dancer up on points. It's a quite wonderful, and it was very good to be reminded of that. That is, the sentiments matter to us only if they are realized in unforgettable expression. So we've got to think that the difference between there is the dance and there the dance is a difference which is huge. It's original with the minimum of alteration. It's simply a matter of word order.
And that beautiful equipoise sort of there that it achieves. Ed, in Boston, you're on with Christopher Ricks. Thank you for calling, Ed.
Hi, Tom. Christopher, given your characterization of T.S. Eliot's departure from Victorian moles and conventions into modernism, at least early on, would there be any echo or resonance of Gerard Manley Hopkins, who came on the scene 30 years after death in 1918?
Eliot himself spoke rather harshly of Hopkins. He's got a page about Hopkins in After Strange Gods, and he certainly thinks that Hopkins had genius, but at the same time he thinks you tend to get more of the same thing in Hopkins, not a development of the original, as it were, opening of a poem. So he was not a huge admirer of Hopkins, and I think it's only really on that one occasion, one page in After Strange Gods, that he much cared about him. I think Hopkins is a genius, all right, and some of the poems, although you're of course quite right to say the volume of poems isn't till the end of the Great War, many of Hopkins's poems had been published in anthologies at the end of the 19th century, so that the it's not true that the world knew nothing of Hopkins until Robert Bridges brought out that edition, because Bridges had brought out anthologies that included Hopkins. But that's a very good point about experiment and innovation.
So here we are, T.S. Eliot. He was such a towering figure in the mid-20th century, just sort of the peak of literary prominence and respect. And then in the late 20th century, I mean, you as you know well, by 1989, Cynthia Ozick was describing him as an autocratic, inhibited, depressed, rather narrow-minded, and considerably bigoted fake Englishman. That's a long way from the top of the mountain. Where do you see his reputation, his resonance now?
The Ozick point? I think Ozick is not, for me, somebody of the top of the mountain, but actually she's not God on Sinai.
Yes, true. Fair.
She expressed her opinion. She said that Eliot isn't even taught anymore. Not true. And so on. Well, Eliot is a highly combative and controversial figure. These reputations that come and go. Mm-hmm. Dying is almost always a bad career move. Mm-hmm. And 1965 saw him dying. And there's always a trough after that when people get...
Also, so is resonance now, given the still point of the world that we're at?
Well, my students love him because I brainwash them.
Of course.
I never meet anybody who says, it's a point that C.S. Lewis made about the great poet Spencer. Lewis said, you never meet anybody who used to like Spencer. Now, I never meet anybody who used to like Eliot. There are people who never like him and so on. Ozick did not persuade me that once upon a time he was of great importance to her. I don't think she said anything that was of the faintest interest about him.
Give us a line that will serve us well as we sit here today.
Oh, it's difficult.
What we call the beginning?
Well, I'd rather you gave me the lines.
I've got one here. I mean, what we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. Does it ring for you, sir?
It certainly does ring. It's not as bodily. I think he's a great bodily.
That's true.
First, let me disclose the gifts reserved for age to set a crown upon your lifetime's effort. First, the cold friction of expiring sense without enchantment. This is this terrible vision. I mean, I'm only 82 and a half, so I haven't yet had to feel these things.
I'll take yours. I knew you had it. It's fully bodily there in the mouth of Christopher Ricks. He and Jim McHugh are out with the poems of T.S. Eliot, Volumes 1 and 2. Marvelous. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.